Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Proverbs chapter 16, which I will call the Proverbs of Solomon, part 7. Solomon begins with verse 1 of Proverbs 16, "The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord." Now, there are some other scriptures that say the same thing. Proverbs 16:9, in this very same chapter, "The mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps." And two verses later in this same chapter 16, we read, "Commit your works to the Lord, and your plans will be established." Proverbs 19:21 says, "Many plans are in a man's heart, but the counsel of the Lord will stand." And Proverbs 21:30 says, "There is no wisdom and no understanding and no counsel against the Lord." Now, there is a contrast here between the internal plans of the heart belonging to man and the external answer of the tongue being from the Lord. The answer of the tongue being the external expression of what the plans are that have been devised in the mind of the man. Now, there are two ways that this proverb has been interpreted. One way says the plans of the heart belong to the man, and also the plans of the heart belong to the Lord. The text doesn't say that, but some people say that that is implied. And so the answer of the tongue, it states the answer of the tongue is from the Lord, but it is implied that the answer of the tongue is from man. So what you have here is God working on the heart of man, coming up with a good plan with the man internally, and then when the man expresses that plan, he does that, but it's from the Lord. So the idea is that man can neither think nor speak without God. The plans in his heart are generally irregular and confused, as John Gill says, and so God must give order to them in order to teach man what to say. Now, the text doesn't actually say that. As Adam Clark points out, it says, "The plans of the heart belong to man, and the answer of the tongue is from the Lord." It does not say the plans of the heart belong to the man and the Lord, and the answer of the tongue is from the man and the Lord. Now, Adam Clark goes on a long discourse about the different ways to interpret this. Adam Clark disagrees with that common interpretation, and I agree with Clark. I don't think that's right. Clark says the text says the plans belong to man, and the implication is that these plans are not God's plans. They're man's plans. There's a contrast between man's plans and God's plans, and that contrast shows that man's plans are not good unless God works on those plans in order to bring out by the tongue, the answer of the tongue, a good plan. Let me begin a quote here from Adam Clark. The sense is perfectly sound, the sense I just gave you. "For there may be 1,000 schemes and arrangements made in the heart of man, which he may earnestly wish God to bring to full effect, that are neither for his good nor God's glory. And therefore it is his interest that God has the answer in his own power." So in other words, man has a plan in his heart, but it's not good. But the answer is a good answer. It comes from the Lord. Continuing with Clark, "At the same time, there is no intimation here that man can prepare his own heart to wait upon or pray into the Lord, or that from the human heart anything good can come." Now, the alternate interpretation does say that. The plans of a man are in his heart, and of course, the Lord's plan is in the man's heart too, and so it's a good plan. But that's not what the text says. "There is no intimation that from the human heart anything good can come," Clark continues, "without divine influence, but simply that he may have many schemes and projects which he may beg God to accomplish. They are not of God, but from himself. Hence our own proverb, man proposes, but God disposes." I have entered the more particularly into the consideration of this text because some are very strenuous in the support of our reading from a supposition that the other defends the heterodox opinion of man's sufficiency to think anything as of himself. This is a little obscure, but what Clark is saying is that the interpretation that says that the Lord is working in the man's plan, just as the man answers from the Lord. So the first part of verse 1 has God working with the man, because a man can't do anything by himself. He can't come up with any good plan. So the Lord has to be working in the man's heart with the man, and then the answer comes from the man and from the Lord. In other words, you distribute the Lord's action between the first and second parts of the verse. And Clark says, those who do that are very much in love with orthodoxy, and they are trying to protect against the idea that a man can come up with a good plan. And he says, but that's not what the Hebrew says. That's not what the verse says. There is no indication that the Lord is working with a man inside of his heart to come up with a plan. So the best interpretation is the man is coming up with bad plans without God, But in contrast with that, if he came up with a good plan, his answer would be from the Lord. And that's the way we're going to take it. So we go now to Proverbs 16:2. All the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the motives. Now, of course, this is referring to a self-righteous man. All the ways of a man are clean in his own sight. That's a self-righteous person. But the Lord weighs the motives. He tries the motives. He judges the motives. And, of course, this implies that the man's motives are faulty, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Now, here are four proverbs that express much the same idea. Proverbs 21:2. Every man's way is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the hearts. He'll check your motives out. Proverbs 24:12, if you say, see, we did not know this, does God not consider it who weighs the hearts? And does he not know it who keeps your soul? And will he not render to man according to his work? This apparently refers to someone who is claiming ignorance of the law or ignorance of the moral law. I didn't know there was anything wrong with doing that. But then God, he looks in your soul, he says, yes, you knew it was wrong. Deep down in your heart, your conscience told you it was wrong. You did it anyway. Proverbs 20:27, the spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all the innermost parts of his being. Just like a man takes a lamp to search an empty building that's dark, likewise, God, Yahweh, takes a lamp and he starts searching the innermost parts of your being that's dark. And he lights it up so that you can see what's wrong and so that God can see what's wrong with your motives. Proverbs 16:25, there is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. I just talked to a brother at church who used to be the most awful atheist pagan you have ever seen in your life. And he used to sincerely believe that Christians were psychologically deranged and sick. And so he would try to do Christians a favor by talking them out of their silly superstition. His way seemed right to him. He said it was only the grace of God that changed his worldview. With irresistible grace. Now, an example of a man who thinks his ways are clean in his own sight is the philanthropist who gives money to the poor. But does he really care about the poor? Or does he care more about getting his name put up on a building or on a plaque on a wall somewhere engraved in gold? God will judge a man's motives. Proverbs 16:3, Solomon says, commit your works to the Lord and your plans will be established. Now, this is a good proverb for Christians who want to go out and do good works without asking God first. Just about 2 weeks ago, I talked to a very dedicated Christian in China, but she was a young Christian, and she had all sorts of opportunities to witness by signing on to tutoring young Chinese kids. And she got herself totally overloaded where she could not physically handle all those kids, and she was all frustrated. And I asked her, I said, did you pray before you took on all these jobs? And she said, no, I just thought it was a good chance to witness. Just because something's good doesn't mean it's God's will. So she had to cancel a lot of her appointments. So this verse says that we should commit our works to the Lord, and then our plans will be established. I've already discussed plans when I just talked about verse 1, 2 verses ago. David himself says in Psalms 37:5, Solomon's father, commit your way to the Lord, trust also in him, and he will do it. That's very similar to what the son Solomon says. Commit your works to the Lord and your plans will be established. There's nothing wrong with having plans, but just make sure that they're God's plans too, or you're going to fail. Proverbs 16:4, the Lord has made everything for its own purpose, even the wicked for the day of evil. Well, now we read that verse and we say, oh, are you saying God made human beings for the purpose of destroying them in the day of evil? Which might be the day of the wicked's destruction or death, or maybe even hell, I don't know. But the idea that people erroneously get from this verse is God made them so he could destroy them. Sounds a lot like superlapsarian Calvinism, if you ask me. Well, John Gill refutes that, and I like this quote because John Gill is sometimes accused of being a hyper-Calvinist, and a hyper-Calvinist might say something like that, oh, God made everything so he could throw everything into hell, or he made everything evil that's evil so he could throw those evil people into hell so he could show his glory. But John Gill says this, it is not the sense of the text nor of any other passage of Scripture that God made man to damn him, nor is this to be inferred from the doctrine of predestination. God made man neither to damn him nor to save him, but for his own glory. And that is secured whether in his salvation or damnation. Nor did or does God make men wicked. He made man upright, and he has made himself wicked. Man has made himself wicked. And being so, God may justly appoint him to damnation for his wickedness, in doing which he glorifies his justice. So, God did not make the wicked in order to destroy him. He made mankind in order to glorify him, and then man made himself wicked by falling. Another objection that might be raised here is that this verse implies that God did not make all things for his glory because he had to destroy some of his creation. No, he did make all things for his glory. Man messed up that glory, and so God says, okay, man, you messed it up. I'm going to fix it by working out the plan of redemption, which is culminated in the book of Revelation, the new Eden, the trees of life, the river of life, the new heavens and the new earth. Everything will be redeemed at the end, and everything will be made new again. The world will be released from its bondage to decay and corruption. So God's going to get his glory back, but he didn't make the wicked in order to glorify himself more. He could have glorified himself if Adam had never sinned. But since Adam did sin, God is going to get more glory, because now God is not only a creator God who creates everything good, he's also a redeeming God who destroys evil. And that is a good thing. So to summarize, when Solomon says that the Lord made the wicked for the day of evil, what he means is the Lord made people, and when they became wicked, God determined that they were going to experience a day of evil. They're going to be destroyed. It's not that he made them for the purpose that they might be wicked and destroyed to glorify God so that people would say, oh, God's a just God. He didn't make them that way. That wasn't his original intention. We go now to Proverbs 16:5. Everyone who is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Assuredly, he will not be unpunished. Now, Solomon says everyone who is proud in heart is an abomination to God. That also includes people who are proud outwardly too, because usually when someone is proud in his heart, that pride manifests itself externally in the course of the man's life. So someone who is proud internally or externally, it doesn't matter. He's an abomination to the Lord, as Proverbs 3:32 says, for the devious are an abomination to the Lord, but he is intimate. The Lord is intimate with the upright. And if the pride in the heart is dissembled and hidden from the outward public, it doesn't make any difference to God. If it's hidden in the heart so that nobody else can see it, God can see it and he will punish it. No matter how well pride is hidden to outsiders, the proud man will not be unpunished. Proverbs 11:21 says the same thing. Assuredly, the evil man will not go unpunished, but the descendants of the righteous will be delivered. We go now to Proverbs 16:6. By loving kindness and truth, iniquity is atoned for, and by the fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil. Now, whose loving kindness and truth is Solomon talking about here? Is he talking about the loving kindness and truth of a man, a person, a human? By a man's loving kindness and truth, is his iniquity atoned for? Or is he talking about the loving kindness and truth of God? By the loving kindness and truth of God, iniquity in general is atoned for, because God atones for sins. Well, if we say this is the loving kindness and truth of an individual person, we have a problem, because now you're talking about humans atoning for sin, and that's not possible. However, you can take it in the sense of making reparation. By loving kindness and truth, a man who has harmed somebody else and committed iniquity can atone for that sin by making restitution and reparations. That's one way you can handle it. Another way is the way Adam Clark does it. He says this is a mere hypothetical. By loving kindness and truth, a man might atone for iniquity if he could, but he can't. I don't think that's what it means. I think that it means that a man is showing loving kindness and truth when he makes reparations for and restitutions for any sin or iniquity that he's committed. And also, by the fear or reverence of the Lord, one keeps away from evil, so you don't do iniquity that needs to be atoned for. We go now to Proverbs 16:7. When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, as a refinement on this, persecutions, of course, are accepted, because your enemies will not be at peace with you when they are persecuting you. This verse doesn't say that every enemy will be at peace. It says, when a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, God makes even his enemies, some enemies, to be at peace with him. It doesn't say all of his enemies to be at peace with him. That's not the real world. But let's face it. A lot of times people who are angry at you do not remain angry at you when you treat them with kindness and love. We go now to Proverbs 16:8. Better is a little with righteousness than great income with injustice. So we have a poor man who's honest in his business dealings, in his financial dealings, opposed to a man who has a lot of money, but who has committed injustice in his business dealings. Now, there are other scriptures that give the same idea. Five Proverbs, Proverbs 15:6. Great wealth is in the house of the righteous, but trouble is in the income of the wicked. Proverbs 15:16. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. Proverbs 15:17. Better is a dish of vegetables where love is than a fattened ox served with hatred. Proverbs 19:1. Better is a poor man who walks in his integrity than he who is perverse in speech and is a fool. Proverbs 28:6. Better is the poor who walks in his integrity than he who is crooked, though he be rich. That reminds me of a Hank Williams song. He talks about he's living in the small cabin down the hill while his ex-girlfriend is living up there in that mansion on the hill, that loveless mansion on the hill. This idea of people being rich and unhappy is everywhere in secular music, in secular literature, in secular entertainment. Watch a Lifetime movie. How many times do you see those rich people happy? Solomon is just making a common observation of the human race. It's better to be poor and honest, and those who are tempted to make money unjustly will pierce themselves with many a pang, as Paul says. They'll hurt themselves badly, because the love of money is the root of all evil. Proverbs 16:9, the mind of a man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Now, this is a righteous man. The mind of a righteous man plans his way. Why? Because the Lord will not direct the steps of a wicked man. This verse says the Lord directs his steps. Well, the Lord's not going to direct the steps of a wicked man. So we have already talked about planning under Proverbs 16:1. There's nothing wrong with planning. He who does not plan plans to fail. As I used to say in teaching management, management, in fact, is one of the five basic management functions. Planning, organizing, controlling, and so forth. Planning is very important, but we need to have our plans subject to the will of God. I mean, even for non-Christians, plans change all the time. You still need to plan, because when you have to change your plans, at least you have got a basis for doing so. You're not acting in a world of chaos and randomness. You need to plan, but you need to commit your plans to the Lord so that the Lord can direct your steps. We go now to Proverbs 16:10. Solomon says, a divine decision is in the lips of the king. His mouth should not err in judgment. This divine decision is what should be, not what actually is. So we read it this way. A divine decision, in other words, a very good, perfect decision from God, is in the lips of the king. In other words, when he is acting in his judicial function, he should not make mistakes. He should judge righteously, and he should have divine decisions at hand. He should make decisions based upon the will of God. Wouldn't it be nice if we had judges like that today? We go to Proverbs 16:11. Solomon says, a just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are his concern. Now here's some other scriptures that talk about just weights. Leviticus 19, verses 35 through 36 in the Mosaic Law. God says, you shall do no wrong in judgment, in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin. An ephah is a solid measure. A hin is a liquid measure. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. Just balances, just weights. Why? Because I'm God, and I'm righteous, and I don't like you cheating people. Proverbs 11:1, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. Proverbs 20:10, differing weights and differing measures, both of them are abominable to the Lord. For example, when you have a weight that says that it's 100 grams, but it's actually 110 grams, so you put it on the scale and you say, put your gold on the other side of the scale, measure out 100 grams of gold, and we're square. So the buyer has to weigh out 110 grams of gold in order to buy something that he thinks is only worth 100 grams. Proverbs 20:23, differing weights are an abomination to the Lord, and a false scale is not good. In the last part of verse 11, we read, all the weights of the bag are God's concern. What is the weights of the bag? Well, it could be back then that weights were kept in a bag until they were used for weighing, and I think that's probably what it is. Some people have speculated that the weights of the bag are standard weights which are kept in the sanctuary, just like we have standard weights and measures in Washington, D.C. somewhere. I don't know exactly where up there it is, but there's a, I think it's a platinum rod that's exactly a foot long or a yard long, measured down to the .00000005 millimeters and things like that. Well, perhaps the people of Israel had just weights kept in a bag in the sanctuary. Interesting speculation. We go now to Proverbs 16:12. It is an abomination for kings to commit wicked acts, for a throne is established on righteousness. Of course, it's an abomination for anybody to commit a wicked act, but it's worse when it's a king, because the king has power. He's an example. He's a role model, and he can cause an awful lot of injustice and unjust kings all throughout history. Today, right now, including in the United States of America, government has created all sorts of injustice for people. Happens all the time. The throne is established on righteousness. There is nothing better when you have a godly man in charge, even if he's not a good president. I think about Jimmy Carter. He was a godly man. He didn't even drink liquor in the White House. He wouldn't even drink wine, I don't think. I mean, I hate that to define godliness that way. He was a horrible president. Excuse me, that's just my opinion, but I think it's the opinion of a lot of people. But at least he wasn't evil. So, yes, a country is blessed when the throne is established on righteousness. In Sri Lanka just recently, all the government officials in Sri Lanka insisted that nobody could use synthetic fertilizer because they were trying to follow the greeny-weeny ways of the EU. They took all the subsidies that they got from, I forgot where, maybe it was from the EU, but they pocketed a lot of money and just left the country. And now Sri Lanka is broke, can't get any more loans from the World Bank. People don't have enough food to eat. Why? Merely because they had unjust rulers. For all of those of you who don't think politics are important and who don't think it's important to vote, well, okay. Don't complain when you're living in misery because your president's throne is not established on righteousness. Proverbs 20:28 says, loyalty and truth preserve the king, and he upholds his throne by righteousness. Of course, Solomon's probably talking about himself. I think he was a very just king. He was a very successful king. He had a lot of wives, and he shouldn't have done that. But as far as government, as far as running the nation of Israel, he did a very, very good job. We go now to Proverbs 16:13. Righteous lips are the delight of kings, and he who speaks right is loved. Now, Solomon was a king, and he liked to have righteous advice from his counselors, and that's what he means when he says righteous lips. He means the lips which are attached to his counselors, his ministers. One of those ministers who speaks right is loved, loved by the king. We go down to Proverbs 16:14. The fury of a king is like messengers of death, but a wise man will appease it, will appease the fury of the king. One death sentence from the king would be bad enough, but the fury of a king here by Solomon is said to be like messengers, plural, of death. The way that people would be executed, at least in classical times, the Roman Empire, the emperor would send a messenger to the soon-to-be-deceased official, and the soldier would say, please get your affairs in order. You're going to have to commit suicide, and I'll watch you. Cut your wrist, get in the tub, let the warm water bleed you out, and you'll be gone. Well, one of those messages is bad enough. But more than one, messengers of death, that's what happens when you get a king angry. Now, to put that in modern-day terms, as far as application, don't get your boss mad at you. Keep your mouth shut. Appease the boss's anger. The boss is right. You are wrong. I've been a subordinate in college administrations all my life. I got along with all of them just by not making the bosses angry. And there were a lot of my fellow professors who loved to do that. And, of course, then the administration went after them, giving them 10 o'clock classes at night and then 8 o'clock classes the next morning, giving them bad evaluations, spurning them, ignoring them. That never happened to me. because I just was nice to everybody. Of course, then the communists did get me and fired me from a job I had in China, but that was because I had a Christian meeting in the apartment that I was living in that had nothing to do with making them angry because I was obnoxious to them. Jonathan, if you remember, wisely appeased the wrath of Saul when Saul decided he was going to go after David, and Jonathan went to his dad and said, "Dad, don't go after David. He loves you." Proverbs 16:15, "And the light of a king's face is life, and his favor is like a cloud with the spring rain." Instead of making the king angry, you need to make him happy. And when you see the king's face lit up with smiles, you know that you have life. "The king's favor is like a cloud with the spring rain." What does that mean? The spring rain is translated here in the NASB as spring rain. In the KJV, it's latter rain. Now, there was one rainy season in Israel from October to April, and there were two critical times during that rainy season. The former rain was from mid-October to early November. The purpose of the former rain was to prepare the ground for plowing and sowing of seed. The latter rain ran at the latter part of the rainy season from late March to early April, and the purpose of the latter rain was to mature the barley grain to prepare it for harvest. That from oneforisrael.org. But I'm not a farmer. I don't care about all that stuff. Just that here we want to say that the latter rain is something good because it means prosperity, it means food, and of course in an agricultural economy, that meant a lot. They had to plant and grow to eat. And so if you saw a cloud with the spring rain, that means you saw food coming out of the sky. And so that would make you happy, just like you would be happy in the light of the king's face. The king giving you favor is just like the spring rain giving you crops to eat. Everybody loves it when the boss says you're doing a good job. Go down to Proverbs 16:16. Solomon says, "How much better it is to get wisdom than gold, and to get understanding is to be chosen above silver." Another proverb that says the same thing is Proverbs 3:14-15. "For she," that's wisdom personified, "is more profitable than silver, and her revenue is better than gold. She is more precious than jewels. Nothing you desire compares with her." How many people you know talk like that? Most people talk about their assets, their bottom line, how much money's in their 401k. We don't talk about getting wisdom. It would be smart to do that, though, because having wisdom is better than having gold. In fact, gaining wealth depends upon wisdom if you want to gain wealth without turmoil in your spirit. A lot of people get wealth along with the turmoil, as we've already seen, but that's not a good way to live. We go now to Proverbs 16:17. "The highway of the upright is to depart from evil. He who watches his way preserves his life." So let's imagine a highway. Evil is behind us and we're on the highway leaving evil. Evil is at our back. We watch our way to make sure we stay on the highway of righteousness as we leave evil behind us. There are other proverbs talking about the way. I know that sounds like Taoism. Tao means way in Chinese. But this is not the way of the universe. This is the way of God. Other proverbs, Proverbs 3:5-6. "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not rely on your own understanding. Think about him in all your ways and he will guide you on the right paths." There are right ways to go in life, and God will keep you on the right way, but you got to think about him in all your ways. You got to commit your way to him. You got to trust in him with all your heart. You can't rely on your own understanding, but if you do all those things, you will stay on the right path, and the right path leads you away from evil and to life. You stay on that way, you preserve your life, this proverb says. Proverbs 4:26-27. "Carefully consider the path for your feet, and all your ways will be established. Don't turn to the right or to the left. Keep your feet away from evil." Stay on the path. We turn now to Proverbs 16:18. Solomon says, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling." Now, this is just an elegant way of saying, like we do, that pride goes before a fall. Here, the pride goes before destruction, which is a little bit stronger than a fall. The classic example of this is when Adam and Eve destroyed the entire human race in their pride. They thought they knew more than God knew. They wanted to be independent of God and not under his commands. A haughty spirit comes before stumbling. Now this verse, appropriately enough, is the middle verse of Proverbs. There are just as many verses before as are after this proverb. A perfect pivot point, a perfect fulcrum for the Book of Wisdom. Pride goes before destruction. The pride of the human race, the deadly son of pride. Now, here's some other scriptures that talk about pride. I've got 13 of them. Proverbs 11:2, when pride comes, then comes dishonor, but with the humble is wisdom. Proverbs 15:33, the fear of the Lord is the instruction for wisdom, and before honor comes humility. Matthew 23:12, whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. And the parallel verse to Matthew 23:12 is in Luke 14:11, says the same thing. Luke 18:14, I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. Proverbs 18:12, before destruction the heart of man is haughty, but humility goes before honor. Proverbs 29:23, a man's pride will bring him low, but a humble spirit will obtain honor. Psalms 138:6, though the Lord is exalted, he takes note of the humble, but he knows the haughty from a distance. Proverbs 3:34, he mocks those who mock, but gives grace to the humble. Matthew 23:12, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. That's another parallel synoptic gospel verse as the two that I read in Mark and Luke. Proverbs 16:19, better to be lowly of spirit with the humble than to divide plunder with the proud. James 4:6, but he gives greater grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That's a direct quote of Proverbs 3:34. 1 Peter 5:5, second part of the verse. All of you, says Peter, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That's Proverbs 3:34 that Peter is quoting. I'll give you an example of this. In 2016, there was a particular candidate for a particular party who was known for being fairly braggadocious. I'm talking about presidential candidate. And so he was in the primary of one of the parties, and the moderator at a debate asked every candidate to tell the audience one salient attribute that they had that would make the voter remember him. And when it came to this candidate, I won't tell you his name, but it rhymes with dump, came to this candidate and he said humility. Now, of course, he was being ironic, and I'll have to admit I broke out laughing because the man was just as proud as he could be. He's always been proud. He's been proud since the day he came out of his mother's womb, and he's proud today. He actually won that race and became president. He lost the next race. I don't know if he's destroyed yet. We'll have to wait and see what happens in the next election 2 years from now. He's not doing too well now, but who knows? Politics is like baseball. It's unpredictable. But I'm telling you, pride goes before a fall. And he's not the only one. He's not the only politician that's been laid low. He's not the only entertainment star or athletic hero that has been brought down by life. We go now to Proverbs 16:19. It is better to be humble in spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. I just read that proverb in the previous verse. I've just read, in fact, 13 long verses about pride, so I won't read any more about that. That just puts a cork in the bottle there. Proverbs 16:20, he who gives attention to the word will find good, and blessed is he who trusts in the Lord. To give attention to the word is translated that way by the NESB, is translated into the KJV by he who handleth a matter wisely shall find good. The NIV says he who gives heed to instruction will find good. I think the NIV is probably more accurate here because in verse 20 in the NASB, it sounds like he who gives attention to the word is one who is giving attention to the written word of God. I don't think that's what Solomon meant, although I believe it could be applied to that. I think the NIV is right. He who gives attention to instruction from his superior, his father, his king, he who gives attention to those words will find good. And of course, if those words are informed by the written word of God, so much the better. Blessed is he who trusts in the Lord. If you give attention to the word of the Lord, of course, you will be trusting in the Lord. Proverbs 16:21, the wise in heart will be called understanding, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. I feel like mentioning that aforesaid presidential candidate. His speech was anything but sweet, and he persuaded about 35% of the country, and he still got him persuaded. But he can't get that other 15% of the middle people one over is because he's constantly damning people with silly pejorative nicknames, calling people all sorts of names. Of course, other people call him the names too, but it becomes a slugfest. And after a while, there ain't no sweetness of speech. And after a while, you realize he ain't going to persuade anybody. The wise in heart will be called understanding. That's not understanding with head knowledge. This is heart wisdom, the wisdom that understands what's right and what's wrong, the heart that understands righteousness, not just a mind that can understand intellectual things. And of course, sweetness of speech comes from a sweet heart. Now, we've got to realize that this proverb cannot be applied universally. After all, we could look at some of Paul's and Jesus's vituperative language, language that was not sweet at all. For example, Paul told the Galatians, "I wish that those who are troubling you would even mutilate themselves." And of course, he's talking about legalists who wished that all the Gentiles in Galatia get circumcised. And so Paul says, well, they're so big on circumcision, I wish they'd go ahead and not only cut their foreskin off, I wish they'd go ahead and castrate themselves and cut their gonads off, cut their penis off. That's pretty vituperative language. That's not sweetness of speech. So this proverb assumes that the people that you're trying to persuade are persuadable. They'll listen to you. They've given you a seat at the table, and you just as nice as you can be and try to say, well, I see what you're saying. I want to understand what you're saying, but let me explain to you why my worldview is superior to yours. It's because it's been revealed by God, and yours is not based upon anything that can stand the test of time. You know, just be nice about it. So Solomon is talking about conversation in normal circumstances. He's not talking about crises like Paul was dealing with. That controversy concerning legalism would have destroyed the church. Paul had to deal with it in no uncertain terms. And of course, Jesus, oh my gosh, he called Pharisees, you blind guides, whitewashed tombs, brood of vipers. That's not sweet speech. That's because these people were evil, and he had to deal with it appropriately. But Solomon is talking about normal situations. Those were unusual circumstances when you're standing against people that are just really dangerous with power and who are not willing to listen to truth. We go now to Proverbs 16:22. Understanding is a fountain of life to one who has it, but the discipline of fools is folly. KJV has the instruction of fools. Understanding is a fountain of life. Well, here are some options as to who the understanding person gives life to. It could be the understanding person gives life to himself. Understanding is a fountain of life to the one who has understanding. Or it could be that the understanding one is speaking to someone else, and that someone else is who receives life as the understanding person speaks. Or, of course, it could be both. The discipline of fools is folly. Well, here are some options as to who the fools are giving folly to. They could be giving foolishness, folly to themselves. The fools could be fooling themselves, if you will. Or it could be that the instruction of fools is giving folly to those who listen to the fool. Or it could be both. Doesn't really matter. The point is we want to avoid foolishness. We want to avoid fools. And if you want to find fools, look at modern day American culture. This is the year 2022. And in the schools, in the universities, there's anti-white and anti-Jewish racism everywhere. There's postmodern solipsism everywhere. There is, let's get rid of free speech because we're fascists and we want to impose our morality on you, but you can't impose your morality on me, even though I say there's no morality. But when it comes to me getting power, yes, there is morality, and it's my morality, and I'm going to screw you, especially if you're a Christian. That's everywhere now. As the church finds itself about ready to go underground in this great Christian country of ours. We're going out of Proverbs 16, verse 23. The heart of the wise instructs his mouth and adds persuasiveness to his lips. The heart of the wise. Let's read Proverbs 16:21, which is just two verses previous. The wise in heart will be called understanding. Wise in their interior being. Not just wise in their head, but wise in their heart. They know what good is. They know what evil is. Not just that they know how to do math and physics. So in verse 23, Solomon says, the heart of the wise instructs his mouth and adds persuasiveness to his lips. So if he is a righteous man whose heart is wise internally, that will eventuate in his external words being righteous also and wise also. His lips will then be more persuasive, so people will be more apt to adapt what the wise person is saying. So you want to be persuasive? Be wise. Proverbs 16, verse 24. Solomon continues, pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. Again, this is talking about normal situations, not talking about when you have to stand up against an enemy in a public place. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, gentle words, kind words, soothing words. They are sweet to the soul. They are healing to the bones. Notice that the immaterial part of man, the soul, and the material part of man, the bones, are connected. Pleasant words will heal your soul and they will heal your bones. So the body and the soul are closely connected. If one is hurt, the other is hurt also, and vice versa. If you are damaged physically, a lot of times your emotions go down and you start acting cranky. On the other hand, if you just start acting cranky for no reason, pretty soon it will affect your body and you're likely to get sick. We go now to Proverbs 16, verse 25. There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Now, this way is not actually right. It just seems right to a man. This proverb is repeated word for word in Proverbs 14:12. This proverb is repeated in Proverbs 14:12, two chapters previous. There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. And the seems right part of the proverb, the first part, there is a way which seems right to a man, that's repeated in verse 2 of this very same chapter, Proverbs 16. All the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the motives. Proverbs 21:2, every man's way is right in his own eyes. And of course, that describes the normal run of the human race. Everybody thinks they're doing what's right, but they're not. They're on the highway to hell. They're on the way of death. We move now to Proverbs 16:26. Solomon says, a worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on. We see a similar thought in Solomon's book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 6, verse 7. All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. His hunger urges him on. This reminds me of a story I read about Larry Bird. He grew up poor, very poor, and as a result, he worked very hard in his basketball career, and after it was over, he said he could think of about two games that he played in all those many, many, many NBA games, including games in which he was half wrecked from injury, two games that he didn't leave everything on the floor working like a dog because he was hungry. This is why so often wealth is made in the first generation and squandered by the second generation, because the second generation didn't grow up hungry and so doesn't work as hard as the first generation. Go down to Proverbs 16:27. Solomon says, a worthless man digs up evil while his words are like scorching fire. Some sins that are long buried need to stay buried. In fact, most of them, in my humble opinion. One's own sin as well as other people's sins. Yeah, we all sin and we're sorry we did it. And if everybody has been made whole and if everybody is forgiven everybody else, don't bring it up again. Don't bring it up in your own mind. Don't bring it up to other people. A worthless man will bring it up and his words are like scorching fire. They burn people up. As John Gill says, his tongue is a fire. It is set on fire of hell, and it sets on fire the course of nature, and with its lies, calumnies, and detractions, devours and consumes the good names, characters, and credit of men, and deserves no other than sharp arrows of the Almighty, and coals of juniper, even the everlasting fire and flames of hell. I wish John Gill were alive so he could tell us what he really thought about people who bring up evil in the past of someone. We go down to Proverbs 16, verse 28. Solomon says, a perverse man spreads strife, and a slanderer separates intimate friends. Now that perverse man is described by the adjective perverse, and I have a little bit trouble translating or defining what perverse means. So I looked at some other translations. In the New American Bible, we have an intriguer sows discord. In the Bible in Basic English, we had a man of twisted purposes, which is my favorite translation. In the Darby translation, we have a false man. In the God's Word translation, we have a devious person. In the Holman Christian Study Bible, we have a contrary man. An intriguer, a man of twisted purposes, a false man, a devious person, a contrary man. He's just a bad man. He spreads strife. Proverbs 6:12-14 says this, a worthless person, a wicked man, goes around speaking dishonestly, winking his eyes, signaling with his feet, and gesturing with his fingers. He always plots evil with perversity in his heart. He stirs up trouble. So there's another perverse man making secret signals to his comrades so he can deprive his target of justice. So this man of twisted purposes doesn't seek peace. He loves strife. And likewise, a slanderer which could be a description of the perverse man. He separates intimate friends. The KJV has a whisperer, separates friends. Proverbs 18:8 says, the words of a whisperer are like dainty morsels, and they go down into the innermost parts of the body. People like to listen to slander and gossip. And the way the whispered words, the slander, would separate an intimate friend, the perverse person goes to friend A and says, your friend B has been saying bad things about you. Your friend B says that you are an immoral jerk. And so now friend A is suspicious of friend B, and he's separated from him. Proverbs 26:20-21 says, for lack of wood, the fire goes out, and where there is no whisperer, contention quiets down. Like charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. So this perverse man, this contrary man, this slanderer, he creates strife even as someone creates fire when he blows on the hot embers of a fire. This is serious business. This slander separates intimate friends. It's hard to find friends, and you've got a very close friend, and all of a sudden you lose him? It would be much better off listening to your friend rather than the one who lies about your friend. I've had personal experience with this. A perverse man, and that's being very kind about him. He's actually a snake in the grass. He came and he busted up one church, almost busted up another church. He deprived me of the friendship of one of the closest friends I've ever had in my life for 8 years. We're now gotten everything back squared away now. But for 8 years, I didn't speak to him. He tried to separate me from another friend in my church, but I told my friend, I said, well, you can listen to him if you want. You might as well listen to a snake in the grass, and I won't have a thing to do with him. He completely destroyed the church of another friend of mine. Now, everything's worked out now, but it took at least 8 years to straighten out. This man has now got basically a cult in England. He's broken up the marriage of a man over there, cost this man millions of dollars in his business. They are now involved in legal action. The man's wife will not speak to him. The man's children will not speak to him because this slander is separating this woman from her husband and these children from her father. He just can't help it. That's what he does. He's a slanderer. He's a perverse man who loves to spread strife. Don't let such a person take hold. Stop him at all cost. Don't give him sweet words. Give him words like Paul gave the Galatian legalist. I would that they were emasculated. We go now to Proverbs 16, verse 29. A man of violence, says Solomon, entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good. He's enticing his neighbor to commit violence with him. Proverbs 3:31 says, do not envy a man of violence and do not choose any of his ways. Proverbs 1:10 says, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Now notice this man of violence is not forcing you to do anything. He's seducing you. He is enticing you. He is trying to lead you. All you have to do is say, no, I'm not going to do that. It's amazing how much evil and sin can be stopped just by the word no. Now sometimes you're forced to do things you don't want to, but usually that's not the case. Usually you're just talked into it and you do it of your own free will. We go now to Proverbs 16:30. The one who narrows his eyes is planning deceptions. The one who compresses his lips brings about evil. Now, the phrase, the one who narrows his eyes, is the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. It's my favorite for this verse. Here's some other translations. The NASB says, the one who winks with his eyes. The Young's Little translation also says, winking with his eyes. So does the ASV, the Darby, the God's Word translation, and also the King James Version. All say the one who winks his eyes is planning deceptions, and that goes along with Proverbs 6:13, making signs with his eyes, as the Bible in Basic English says, making signs with his eyes, rubbing with his feet, and giving news with his fingers. In other words, you're secretly conveying messages to your cohorts as you enter into a conspiracy to screw your target. So you make signs that the target doesn't understand. And maybe that's the correct translation, who winks with his eyes. But I like the Holman Christian Study Bible, the one who narrows his eyes. Adam Clark says this is in order to keep out all ideas that have nothing to do with sin. It denotes deep thought. He's planning how to deceive somebody. He's planning on how to bring about evil to somebody. He's narrowing his eyes and focusing on his evil. And then, in the second part of verse 30, the one who compresses his lips brings about evil. The NIV says the one who purses his lips brings about evil. Why does he compress his lips? Because he's deep in thought. He concentrates. He's not flapping his lips talking to anybody. He's just got his mouth shut because he is focused on doing evil. Proverbs 16:31, Solomon says, a gray head is a crown of glory. It is found in the way of righteousness. Here's what John Gill says about a gray head. Gray hairs, white locks through age are very ornamental, look very beautiful, bespeak gravity, wisdom, and prudence, and command reverence and respect. I should look at myself in the mirror sometimes and see if I look very beautiful and if I bespeak gravity, wisdom, and prudence. I never quite looked at it that way. I think because of my culture, people don't honor old people very much. When I was in China, I was 59 and a half, almost 60 years old. I was riding in a taxi. Taxi driver asked me how old I was. I said, I'm almost 60. He says, oh, you're such a lucky man. 60. Oh, this is wonderful. Because in China, old is good. It is very good. And I found out that 60 is especially good for some reason, hidden deep within the bowels of Chinese culture. I didn't understand why, like 99% of the things I didn't understand in China. But I thought, well, isn't that cool? I'm now 60 years old and everybody thinks I'm a wonderful person. Proverbs 20, verse 29 says, the glory of young men is their strength, and the honor of old men is their gray hair. The last part of the verse in the NASB translation says, it is found in the way of righteousness, the it referring to the gray head. The gray head is found in the way of righteousness. Now, there's a couple of ways we can look at this. First of all, if you assume that there's an if in front of it is found, if it is found in the way of righteousness, a gray head is a crown of glory if it is found in the way of righteousness. And the idea behind this is there's lots of gray heads out there, lots of sinners that got gray hair. So a gray head is not necessarily an indication of one walking in the way of righteousness. But if that gray head is found in the way of righteousness, then it becomes a crown of glory. That makes a lot of sense. John Gill says the if ought to be there. Adam Clark says the latter part of the verse is very well added, for many a sinner has a hoary head. In other words, the if is very well added because, just as I just said, lots of sinners have a hoary head. There's no glory in that. James Fawcett Brown says, the if may be properly supplied. If it is found in the way of righteousness, the gray head is a crown of glory. Now, here's some other translations that actually supply the if. It's not in the original text, in the original Greek. In the KJV, we read, the hoary head is a crown of glory if it be found in the way of righteousness. The Bible in Basic English says, the gray head is a crown of glory if it is seen in the way of righteousness. Proverbs 16:31 says, the hoary head is a crown of glory if it is found in the way of righteousness. Well, if you leave the if out and don't supply it like the NASB does, let's interpret it that way. A gray head is a crown of glory. It is found in the way of righteousness. The sense then would be that long life is a reward for righteousness. In other words, if you have a righteous person, he is likely to have a gray head because he's going to live a long time because of his righteousness, because long life is a reward for righteousness. Proverbs 3:16a says, long life is in wisdom's right hand. Proverbs 4:10 says, hear my son and accept my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. In fact, there's a whole ton of long life proverbs. I'm not going to read them all to you. So to summarize, Proverbs 16:31, you can interpret it this way. A gray head is a crown of glory if it is found in the way of righteousness. A gray head is glory. Or you can interpret it this way. If you're righteous, then you will live long enough to have a gray head. We go now to Proverbs 16:32. Solomon says, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city. Being slow to anger is a virtue that is so virtually recognized, says Adam Clark, that most nations have similar proverbs. Here's some other scriptures, other proverbs that state the same thing. Proverbs 14:29. He who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly. Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Proverbs 15:18, a hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger calms a dispute. Proverbs 25:15, by forbearance a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue breaks the bone. Proverbs 12:16, a fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. Proverbs 29:11, a fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. Proverbs 14:17, a quick-tempered man acts foolishly, and a man of evil devices is hated. Proverbs 29:22. An angry man stirs up strife, and a hot-tempered man abounds in transgression. In other words, don't lose your temper. If you can keep from losing your temper, you're better than the mighty. You're better than Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great famously slew his friend, his close friend, in a drunken rage at a banquet as he was conquering Persia. I've read a couple biographies of Alexander the Great, and every time I get to that banquet, I just cringe. He killed Clytus, C-L-Y-T-U-S, the best and most intimate of all of his friends, and he was very, very distraught about it long afterwards, too, simply because he couldn't control his anger. And he who rules his spirit, says the NASB, that's translated by the NIV, as he who controls his temper. Ruling your spirit means to control your temper. We go now to the last verse in Proverbs 16, verse 33, and Solomon says this, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." Now, here we have an interesting proverb. Does this give us sanction to cast lots today? After all, Solomon says that every decision of the lot is from the Lord, so if you want to know the Lord's will, why don't we just throw some dice? Well, I don't know about you, but I am wary of that. So here's the question. Is it proper to use a lot today? Here's how Adam Clark answers that. He says, quote, "How far it may be proper now to put difficult matters to the lot after earnest prayer and supplication, I cannot say." So Adam Clark is as ambivalent about this as I am. Formerly, it was both lawful and efficient, for after it, the lot, was solemnly cast, the decision was taken as coming immediately from the Lord. It is still practiced, casting the lot, and its use is allowed even by writers on civil law, which is amazing. This is in the 1800s, of course. I doubt it's allowed today. But those who need most to have recourse to the lot are those who have not piety to pray nor faith to trust to God for a positive decision. The lot should never be resorted to in indifferent matters. They should be those of the greatest importance, in which it appears impossible for human prudence or foresight to determine. In such cases, the lot is an appeal to God, and he disposes of it according to his goodness, mercy, and truth. The result, therefore, cannot be fortuitous. So Adam Clark says if it's a serious matter, it's okay to throw a lot today. Now, I don't know about that. This one is on my theological do list. My church has a theology night. I'm going to bring it up next theology night and see what they say. But I've never done it, and I don't intend to do it. If somebody told me they were going to do it, I might not be able to say, no, they shouldn't. But I don't think it's very wise. Now, how was the lot used back then? Well, nobody really knows. Somebody has said, some commentator has said, that the lot being cast into the lap, as verse 33 says, refers to something being thrown into a hat, a cap, or an urn, or whatever the person has in his lap. I guess you can think of it as dice. If the numbers on the dice are 1 through 3, we will take course A. If the numbers are 4, 5, or 6, we will take cast B. You have a little box on your lap, you throw the dice in there, and you can come up with the answer. Now, of course, that's probably not how they did it. I don't even know if they had dice, but they had some way to do it, and no commentator I've ever seen knows exactly how ancient Hebrews cast lots. Note that the proverb says that the lot's every decision is from the Lord. As John Gill says, there is no such thing as chance. You have really got to trust God to know that God is behind the decision that the lot has made, especially if people's lives are at stake. So every decision from the lot is from the Lord, and so casting lots ought not to be done superstitiously. Rather, they should be cast to solve disputes that can't otherwise be resolved, and they shouldn't be used in trivial matters, as Adam Clark has already said. A lot has the nature of an oath, says John Gill. A lot is an appeal to the omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent God. So I guess you could say throwing a lot is an act of faith. But it's not something we do today. Maybe we should. I do not advocate it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, with that indecisive remark, I'm now finished with Proverbs 17, and I'm now prepared in our next audio to go to Proverbs 17, which I will call Proverbs of Solomon Part 8. I hope you stay tuned for some more wisdom in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.